Not gonna lie, I was kind of like the NBA. Took a little bit of a hiatus, but we are back for good. I say we because I have a special guest, one that will hopefully be joining me quite often, Tanner Binzak. Tanner, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Zach. Thanks for having me on. I was told, I'm going to preface this with saying this is not a true statement. Zach Courtney told me to say this statement. I am an expert in economics. I know everything there is to know about economics. So you should take everything that I say with zero grains of salt because I'm a master. But no, actually, in reality, I don't know everything. I'd probably be the first to admit that I don't know enough and I don't know a lot. But, you know, I have some rather strong opinions or strong voice. I like to be loud when I talk about this stuff and kind of get heated. But I'm doing good.
What's your major?
I study economics here at Minnesota, with a minor in music, dabbled in music a little bit, still do, and hoping to go to law school in about a little bit over a year here. So
once I become president, you will be managing monetary policy for the Federal Reserve for me.
Yeah, and I'll be bailing you out of jail every couple months.
Well, we're not supposed to talk about that. I suppose I can just pardon you, so it doesn't matter.
Right, exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into it. Today we are talking about policy issues. So I'm a political science major. He's economics, kind of got the best of both worlds. What is the best way to fix the wealth gap? Three main things that we're discussing are increase in the minimum wage, a negative income tax, and a universal basic income, or a UBI. This is probably my favorite political topic to discuss. If you hear me say that and you say, what the hell are those three things? Well, that's what we're here for. And with that being said, episode two, Courtney Convos, let's Convos with Tanner Binzak. Play the music. Hey, we're back. Tanner, that was some pretty good music, wasn't it?
That was great.
All right. So, three things we're going to talk about again. Increase in the minimum wage. We'll say to $15 an hour, right? Because that's the main thing that's discussed. Negative income tax or a universal basic income. First, we'll talk about how each of these works. Tanner, tell us how an increase of the minimum wage to $15 an hour would work.
Well, I think that's probably the most cut and dry of the three topics we're talking about. It's pretty much just what it sounds. Right now, the national minimum wage is, or the federal, is $7.25. Some states are above that, but all states have to be at least at $7.25. A national increase in minimum wage would bump that up to $15 an hour nationwide. That means many states would have to bring, well, I think all states. I don't think there are any states that are at 15, correct?
I want to say maybe like Washington is, but I guess I don't know.
Okay. So, but very few, you know, I'm from Wisconsin. I know Wisconsin is going to bump it up all the way. They're at 725 right now. But like in the basic sense of it, that's all it's going to be. Minimum wage is going to increase if you're an hourly worker.
Yeah. And it's really mostly pretty simple. I think you had it right. There are three states with a minimum wage of $15 an hour, California, Massachusetts, and New York, plus D.C. And New Jersey will reach $15 an hour by 2024. We got some quick fact checks going here.
Yeah.
But so the minimum wage, that's really something that I suppose only the left wing of the Democratic Party really emphasizes, say AOC or Bernie Sanders. Technically, Biden endorses a $15 minimum wage. But I'm a big believer that if someone doesn't actively talk about something, they don't really believe it. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of get that. I also think that, you know, maybe for Biden, it's not the biggest thing on his plate right now. I know, I'll admit, I think that that bumping it all the way to 15 might be a little bit too high because every state is so different. I believe that there should be an increase from the 725 that it is now. But, you know, 15 in some states could be a little bit intense. And I know that we will talk about this at some point today, but, you know, kind of doing a split minimum wage could also help supplement that.
Yeah, so that's a little bit of a teaser. We're just kind of giving a little bit of teasers.
Yeah.
Now we're going to go into a negative income tax. So I don't know how familiar you are with the negative income tax. I suppose I'll explain this one. So negative income tax, if we're going to say one of these is a libertarian policy or conservative policy, you'd probably say it's this one, right? Negative income tax?
Yeah, out of the three, yeah.
So Milton Friedman, no one knows who Milton Friedman is. He's a hardcore libertarian, anti-government economist who is no longer with us, right?
I don't think so. I can look it up, though.
But anyways, he had the idea of, so I think most people agree that we need some type of a welfare state, something to supplement people who aren't able to meet ends meet. And right now, obviously, that looks like, you know, food stamps or housing vouchers or whatever. But his idea was, no, I'm a hardcore capitalist. How about we just give people cold, hard cash? So, like, let's, right now, say if you make $150,000 in income, your tax rate is 26% or something. I don't know actually what it is, but let's say that's what it is for a second. Then you pay 26% of that $150,000. But in a negative income tax, say they set the floor at $36,000. So if you make $0, then the federal government would give you $18,000 to spend on things. So if you make $0, that's what you would get. But then it slowly phases out, obviously, over time if it's a 50% rate, negative 50% rate. So if you make $16,000 a year, you're $20,000 away from that $36,000. So they give you $10,000. So the philosophy behind it is that a more work is always better because you'll always make more money, whereas one of the problems and critiques of, say, food stamps or housing vouchers is sometimes you either have it or then you lose it, or disability is another thing. So if that you make a certain amount of money, boom, it's gone. So sometimes it's in the best interest of those people to not work at all when they could maybe work a little bit.
Yeah, and you're actually pretty close to on the money. I just looked it up. The if you're making $150,000 a year, your income tax is going to be about 24%. So you're pretty close on the money. And yeah, sadly, Milton Friedman did leave us in 2006. I personally, I don't know a lot about him, but I've had to read a couple of different articles by him, a little bit about him, because he is a pretty famous economist.
I think we should hire someone to be like our like fact checker guy, you know, like while we're talking.
Yeah, we can make Zach Duncanson do it.
We need an intelligent person, I was thinking. But then the last thing that we have to talk about is universal basic income, or UBI. So how about you talk about this? I'll give you the simple ones.
Okay.
Pretty simple idea.
Yeah. So I know that you personally love this one, so I'm surprised you're handing it off to me. But if I understand it correctly, pretty much a UBI is essentially you're going to give people money periodically. I was looking a little bit into the history of it, and it's worked differently when different people in different societies have used it. But the basic idea, and I think what Andrew Yang kind of wanted, was essentially, was it every 2 weeks or every month?
He wanted $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
For every American adult that's at least 18 years old.
Yep. So pretty much whether you're working or not, and at least I think whether you're working or not,
yep.
You just get a check periodically to help supplement your income, help make sure that you are able to make ends meet.
And the thing about us is you and I would each get $1,000 a month, but that would also mean that Mark Zuckerberg is getting $1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So that some people will see that as a downside, but I think we'll get into that in just a minute about if that's really a downside. But the thing about UBI, so Andrew Yang supports it, but this is one that really has had bipartisan appeal in a different sense since the pandemic hit with regards to just sending checks out to people. I mean, unconditional or at least close to unconditional checks is as close as you're going to get to universal basic income. I mean, I'm not going to be the first to say that I'm a fan of Donald Trump, but he's trying to push some of the hardcore right-winger conservatives into sending out another round of $1,200 checks right now.
Right. I mean, essentially, in raw definition, that is what a UBI is. It doesn't matter how periodic it is, if it's a one-time thing, if it's every month, if it's every 2 weeks, giving people a lump sum of cash at any point that anybody can obtain is a UBI. So we're seeing that is kind of happening right now in the form of stimulus checks.
So let's now we're going to go in reverse kind of. So now we're going to talk about the pros and cons of each is kind of going to be what we're going to talk about. So let's start off with minimum wage. So what do you think some of the, I mean, the pros are maybe obvious that more people have more money to spend. You maybe raise the poverty level. But what would you say some of the negatives are with the minimum wage increase to $15 an hour?
I think bumping it all the way to 15, one of the biggest ones is if you're looking at your local businesses or your small businesses, a lot of them, even the minimum wages in their states right now is hard to make because they aren't making as big of a profit as, say, Target or Walmart, you know, those kind of places. So they need to save every single dollar that they make. And so if you bump a minimum wage all the way up to $15 and you say you've been paying your workers $10 an hour, let's say that's even above the minimum wage in your state. So you're paying them more than you should be right now or more than you legally are required to. You now have to pay every single one of them $5 more an hour. And now you're screwed because you don't have enough money in your pockets at the end of the day to keep the lights on in your business. So I think that that's a big negative for small businesses to bump the minimum wage all the way up to $15 an hour.
Yeah, so to be honest, I think this would be better than nothing, bumping up the minimum wage a little bit. I think the other two ideas are both better. Hopefully that makes me seem a little less liberal to some of my Wilmer friends who seem to think, I don't know, I'm Fidel Castro or something. But I think one of the main problems with the minimum wage increase to $15 an hour is, first of all, just like the crazy change that it would cause to these people's business plan. Because the reality is, if you're paying four people at $10 an hour right now, say for easy math, that's $40 an hour. But if you increase that to $15 an hour, that is a 50% increase in your wages. If in the scenario where you were to keep all of your employees at the same number of hours per week, which sounds like a good idea, but it doesn't seem like it would be a reality that would happen.
Right. And so, you know, I know we're still kind of talking the negatives, but when you do that, I think that, you know, personally, if I was going to say I back a large minimum wage increase, it's for the long-term goal, which is hard, especially in a time right now in a pandemic where we really need economic relief for the middle and lower class. We need that right now to make sure that as a country we can stay afloat. You know, one thing we're talking about a lot of our economics classes is you can't have an economy and you can't make money if you don't have people that can spend money. That's just like,
yeah,
that's basic. So, yeah.
Well, so the other thing that I'll say though is we talked about the split minimum wage. So I think we'll get into that now maybe a little bit. But so people like Jeff Bezos, Amazon, richest person in the world, and the Walton family, which is with Walmart, two of these huge retailers, they have actually lobbied Congress to increase the minimum wage federally to $15 an hour because they know that that would drive – they know, we all know that that would drive out all small businesses and competitors, which is not what we want. We don't want to have a society where – we consolidate power even more than it already is, and where there's no small businesses, and you either own Amazon or you work for Amazon. That's not something that we want.
Right. And so, you know, with the split, which we can kind of go in more and explain that, but I think that helps combat this or combat, you know, kind of what, you know, Jeff mm-hmm. Bezos and the Waltons, you know, possibly, you know, we can't, they aren't, you know, strictly saying we want this to get rid of businesses, but it's pretty obvious that their lives would be better off if, you know, mom and pop shops weren't up everywhere.
Yeah. And the thing is right now, I mean, something that Andrew Yang talked a lot about when he was running for president in the Democratic primary is that that's already starting to happen, is these businesses are starting to shut down because, like, think if you want something, I'm much more likely to order it on Amazon through my phone and it'll be here in 2 days than going to a store, especially during a pandemic when I don't want to go out. That's just the reality, and obviously other people feel that way because Bezos, his net worth is going through the roof. More and more companies are shutting down, which means more and more jobs are lost, which means more and more malls are closing. All of these things are going to change our society over the next decade to two decades, and I feel like a minimum wage jump right up to 15 would maybe just speed that up. I don't know if you think likewise.
No, yeah, I think that, you know, I think it would essentially create sort of like an oligopoly where essentially the big dogs on top, they're going to control everything. And because like you were saying, we see it now, people don't want to go to the store, so they order stuff online. And, you know, a lot of mom and pop shops, a lot of these smaller local businesses are having to readjust how they do things and invest more to do delivery service so they can stay competitive at all. And if you bump up minimum wage, Amazon is going to be able to keep driving down their prices of stuff in their store and Walmart. And even if it's not the best quality, people take it. So they're going to drive down those prices. People are going to buy there before they, you know, if you can get a phone charger from Amazon for $3 and you got to go to a store down the street and pay 10, you're going to get it off Amazon, you know, and you know, that might be a moot point because, you know, your mom, you know, a local store isn't going to sell that, but it's, you know, the basic principle with all different kinds of goods and services that if it's cheaper, you're probably going to go and get the cheaper one. I know that I do that and I try to shop local when I can, and I'm doing that more and more because I'm now more aware of what's, you know, potentially could happen. But, you know, that's not going to happen enough if we bump the minimum wage straight up, at least initially, I think, you know.
So, and then I think the next point that we'll get to is, I mean, right now we're at 7.25, and I think we can agree that 7.25 isn't really enough to make ends meet.
Well, no, yeah. And honestly, I think that most people would agree with that. And I think that you'd be kind of crazy. You know, if you were a minimum wage worker and you're making $7.25, you'd be pissed off. You'd be irate because you're not going to be able to make ends meet. I mean, I was making $7.25 when I was working at a grocery store and it sucked. And I felt, and, you know, I was a 16-year-old kid. So, you know, I was a little bit entitled, but I don't think I was getting paid enough for that. I don't think that the lady who was 30 years old was getting paid enough for that.
So, yeah, the one argument in favor of a lower minimum wage that maybe Milton Friedman would argue for is that the low minimum wage ensures that a 16-year-old knucklehead, like, I mean, you're still a knucklehead today, but especially right. When you're 16, that you're able to get a job, because maybe if we raise it to $15 an hour, people aren't going to be able to get those jobs because it's too much of a risk. And, I mean, we don't know, but I think that's a worthwhile argument to have.
Right. And so I view things a lot, and I think that this might be, you know, my education, might be my father. My father's told me a lot, you know, to look into the future and look ahead. And we talk about that in economics. You look shortly at what's right in front of you, and then you look at what's ahead of you. And I think that a big thing that for any of these systems, because any of these things that we're talking about today essentially are going to put more money into people's hands, is you need to have financial literacy. And that doesn't mean you have to know how to invest your money and become a millionaire off of penny stocks. That means that we have to start teaching people, whether that's in high school, middle school, elementary school, or at any stage of education or even just in life, how to spend and use money wisely. Because if you gave a monkey $15 an hour, probably not going to spend it wisely. Honestly, if I was 16 getting paid $15 an hour, heck, the $7.25 that I was getting paid, I probably didn't spend it wisely. Some of it I might have. But I guarantee you that any money that I have in my bank account right now is not there because of that $7.25 that I was making when I was 16 years old. That's money that I've made recently. And now I'm, you know, learning financial literacy, and I did in high school because I took personal finance, but that wasn't required. That was a class that my dad said, you should take this class. And I took it. I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. I learned how to balance a checkbook. I know people now that don't know how to balance a checkbook, and they pay taxes, and they're adults that live on their own, and they don't know how to do basic financial things. And I don't think that that's necessarily their fault. I think that that's, you know, an education problem that, you know, is maybe a topic for another day. But I think that if we can increase financial literacy at a basic level and teach people how to spend and save money wisely, that any of these systems can be extremely effective.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. I mean, I might be a high school economics teacher one day, so maybe that's something I can bring in. I don't know why you're not going into education, if I'm being honest. You're crazy. You just want to go into law school. But so then the next thing that I wanted to get into is, so commonly something that people will say is, well, yeah, but those people that make $7.25 an hour, if they would have just went to college and gotten a college degree, they could have become a lawyer and they could have made more money. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I'll say this. This April, I signed up for the LSAT. It cost me $600. And that, you know, pays for a lot of different fees. But that was just to take the test. And granted, there are, you know, you can get fee and waivers and get cut some of the costs. But still, because of lack of funds, that isn't there for everybody. And those fee waivers are not always 100%. Sometimes, yes, you can get 100% off, but not every school is going to honor that. And not everywhere is going to honor that, because if you, so if with, through the LSAT, if you get a fee waiver on your exam, your report, you don't have to pay for any score reports, and you don't have to pay for some schools' application fees. But so for Minnesota, to just to apply, not to get in, not for anything, I'm going to pay over $100 just for them to look at my LSAT score and say, maybe we'll take you. If you're going to law school, you are not applying to just one school. You're going to apply to 3, 4, 5, 6 schools, and that's going to be over $100 every single time that you apply, plus $600. Yes, some of the fees are going to be cut, but if you're someone who is struggling and living paycheck to paycheck, you cannot afford to take the risk of having those extra expenses, because it is a risk. There's a chance that I don't get accepted to any of the schools, just like for an undergrad education. There is a chance that you don't get into any of the schools that you apply to, or that you don't get financial aid, whether that's scholarships or from the government or from the school. So yes, they could have worked. Some people definitely could have worked harder. You know, some of those people that are in that 725, they deserve to be there. But I don't think that's the majority of people. I think that there is a lack of resources that prevents people from taking that step.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are good points that you made. And obviously, you're more of an expert on the world of law than I am. But see, my take on it is that, like, yes, lawyer is a very important degree. We need good lawyers, and they should make more than somebody who works at McDonald's. But at the same time, for our society to function on the little teeter-totter that's on, if that makes sense, we need people to work at McDonald's. That's how our society works. We can't have 330 million people with a college degree that want to go to law school. That's not how an economy works.
Right.
You need people who do different things. You need people that work at the grocery store. You need people that work at the McDonald's. You need people that work in the Walmart. That's, I mean, I don't know. It sounds simplistic, but that's the way that a society works. And it can't just be 16-year-olds. That's not how it can function.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if my dad's going to be listening to this, but my dad told me countless times. I remember when we repainted my room, he wanted me to put this on the wall. He thinks it's like the funniest thing ever. But he also thinks, he also takes it seriously when he says this, and he understands the importance of this statement that the world needs ditch diggers too. We need every single role to function as a society.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are some good points. I think we're done with minimum wage, right? So
yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the next thing on our list, negative income tax. Courtney Combos, thanks for joining us.
Hey guys, it's Zach. Thanks for listening to this episode of Courtney Combos. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. To help this podcast really take off, I could use your help. A retweet will help me get a bigger following, but a small donation, even just a couple dollars, will help me to get rid of the ugly watermarks on the music and to buy a decent microphone. Please consider donating, even just a couple bucks, either at anchor.fm/CourtneyCombos or at my Venmo at zcourtney6. Now, let's get back to the convo. Hello.
All right, we're back. That was some good music, wasn't it?
I thought that was an ad read, but sure. It was great music, great ad read. Whatever went in that little gap, it was great.
You're supposed to play along with it, like you know that was going to be music ad read.
Well, but you know, now we're doing a funny bit because I looked stupid and...
You are stupid.
Well,
so,
yes.
Except for economics. You know about economics.
Sometimes.
So, negative income tax. Milton Friedman, hardcore libertarian. What say you about a negative income tax?
I think it's a cool concept, which I guess isn't really what you want to hear about, you know, something that could possibly go into effect. You don't want to hear it's cool. You want to hear it works. I don't know a ton about the history of it, but the idea of it is very interesting to me. I would love to do research on this, you know, look at or possibly build some statistical models to look at how this would function in a society.
Yeah, I think the main concept behind it is, so first of all, yes, you need a social net behind people. And I think we'll get into the socialism question in just a second. But the thing about a negative income tax is it kind of takes out the gunk and the bureaucracy behind, we need to find out how much money these people make. We need to figure out good ways to send them out housing vouchers and good ways to send them out food stamps and to decide what is eligible for food stamps and all of those types of things. Because, I mean, if you're a true pure market capitalist, you believe that, hey, people are going to figure out how to spend their money. And I don't think it's reasonable to think that if we switch to a negative income tax, I mean, the negative view would be those people are going to spend it on booze and drugs. I have a better view of humans than that. That, I mean, I think if you have two kids and a wife, that you're going to do better things than go out and buy booze and drugs. You're going to get food. You're going to pay your rent or your mortgage. I genuinely believe that. And it maybe is more bang for your buck, I suppose is what you could say, because you get rid of the administrative costs. I mean, it's the same type of philosophy with Bernie's Medicare for All, really.
Right. And, you know, honestly, as horrible as it sounds, even if that money is going to spending it or going to booze and, you know, and drugs, as long as it's, you know, let's say tobacco in this case or marijuana where it's legal, that's money that's going back into the economy. As horrible as that sounds, I'm with Courtney. I think that for the most part, people are good. You know, a lot of the people that really need it and that would use it well are families, you know, families that just can't make ends meet and they're going to spend it well. But even if it's going to people who aren't spending it well, that's still money that's circulating. And I've had a lot of conversations with different people over the past couple months talking about if we can get money into the hands of people who are a little bit lower income or even middle class, they're going to spend the money. And whatever they spend it on, that's going to go back into the economy. It's going to circulate. It's going to improve the economy, at least in the short run, hopefully in the long run. And that, I think, is what people want. You know, I don't think there's anybody out there that's saying that they don't want a good economy.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the biggest problem that we have right now is we have the biggest wealth gap since 1929. And if no one's ever taken an American history course, 1929 was the Great Depression, and it was followed by, it was the stock market crash followed by some of the worst years in American history as far as an economy is concerned. So we need to act quickly to get out of that. That's why that this is viewed, at least in my mind, as such an important topic. Because if we don't do something soon, we're going to have even a worse economic collapse than we're having right now. And right now is probably the biggest crisis that we've had since the Great Depression. I mean, if you look at pure GDP numbers, it's worse than 2009 with the market, the housing market crash. And I think maybe 86 was the next biggest thing. But no, it's been the worst since 1929. And I mean, I think the wealth gap is the biggest thing for that.
Right. And I think the really tricky thing right now is if you are someone who's in the upper middle class, you're not going to be as highly affected by it because of the way the wage gap is working. It's really it's splitting the middle class. And so I think that that's what's really hard to see is when it was the Great Depression, it was just about everybody except for the upper class. But now the way the wage gap has been divided, when we say, you know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, I think that that's a very relative term. It's the relatively rich get richer as well, and the relatively poor get poorer as well. I think that it's not, you know, as cut and dry of a line as it used to be. And but I still think that it is a huge problem.
Yeah, well, and I think the biggest thing is that less and less is there a true freedom of opportunity that they talk about and that the founding fathers always talk about, the freedom of opportunity. That's less and less of a thing. I want to say it's something like in the single digit percentages of maybe 8% of people actually jump a economic class from their parents. That's not what we want it to be. We want to have the opportunity for everyone to be able to. And I don't think we can just pin that down to, oh, those people didn't work hard enough, because that's not how it works. I know a lot of people who are great people who work their butt off, but just the way things work and the way statistics work is you are
likely to be in the same or lower economic class as your parents.
Yeah, and so when you're saying freedom of opportunity, I think that, you know, not to let people get mistaken on this, this isn't saying that, you know, back when the founding fathers existed, everybody was free and everyone had the same opportunity. What it's saying is what they said in the Constitution, if we're going to interpret the Constitution literally, which we shouldn't, I don't think, at least, talking from a law standpoint, they wanted truly everyone to be free. If you're looking at just the words on the page, not what they actually thought, because we know a lot of them, you know, had slaves, didn't really care for people of color, for any sorts of immigrants, which is, you know, kind of a crazy topic right now. But we need to be constantly striving for more freedom and for more opportunity, because I was given more opportunity than my parents were, and they were still given a decent amount of opportunity. And I hope that, you know, if I ever have kids, or if not, if I ever have nieces and nephews, that they have more opportunity than I have financially, career-wise, family-wise, in terms of every aspect of their lives. That's something that I think as humans we crave.
And I'll throw a name in here, Rutger Bregman. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a Dutch historian, I suppose is what you would say that he is. But he's a big proponent for both a negative income tax and a universal basic income. And he's wrote many books on this type of thing, something that I want to get to once maybe I have a little bit of free time at some point. And it's called Humankind, A Hopeful History. And he talked about the, quote, radical idea that most people are decent. And I think that that's something we need to get back to. Like, yes, we need some level of capitalism, but we maybe can't be to the full laissez-faire capitalism where it's just every man for himself. That's how you get the Rockefellers to happen. That's how you get the economic depressions to happen. We don't want any of that. We want a society where everyone's able to have a family. That's another thing that's down, is people having kids is down. Suicide rates are up. Drug addictions are up. These are all tied to the economy. I don't think we can say that the racial justice riots and marches and tension isn't at all ignited by the economic downturn that we're in. And I don't know yet if we'll call it a recession or a depression, but all of that kind of just puts people on edge.
Yeah. And honestly, I think that, you know, even if it's not one of the largest factors in everything that's going on, it's one of the factors that pushed it over the edge and caused it to be what it is. You know, I think that much like the 2008 economic crash, in terms of what's happening right now, in terms of social justice, this was a long time coming. You know, I couldn't have told you that would have happened this summer or this May when it happened, but I'm not surprised it happened. I'm surprised that it didn't happen sooner. I think that it's a long time coming, and there was just the right amount of factors, one of them being the economic downturn that just pushed everybody over the edge.
Yeah, and I think another thing that maybe not today that we're getting into, but that we need to at some point, is whether our government truly works for us, and the problems that come with big corporations putting tons of money into politics that kind of just distort the public perception of things. And those are the type of people that will talk badly about these types of policies, because it's maybe going to hurt the corporations that fund these politicians, but it might help the general population. But they're able to distort this view so much that so many people, and I mean, this is Republicans and Democrats, but it just distorts the view so much that it changes so many people's views on things. And that goes for CNN, that goes for Fox News, MSNBC, it goes for the politicians, it goes for everyone. And Lawrence Lessig, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he's a law professor at your future university, Harvard. And he wrote a book recently that I also want to read called They Don't Work For Us, They Don't Represent Us. One of those, I'm going to look it up right now. But that's the main basis of it, is that we need some level of, he calls it democracy reform, so that we can get these types of things done. Because these types of things are going to help everyone. Maybe not as far as Jeff Bezos might not be able to sit on billions of dollars. And I know some of that's in wealth, but the majority of it's in wealth, but still dollars. And we need to redistribute that, because we need a world where everyone can live and sustain a healthy life. And we don't want people dying of
drug overdoses and those types of things. So I don't know what you have to say about that.
Well, no, yeah. And one day I'll let you put on my tinfoil hat and we'll sit in here. We can talk about all my crazy government conspiracy theories and crazy thoughts that I have in terms of anarchistic law and, you know, just completely abolishing the government and getting rid of two-party system. But, you know, that's – I could talk about that.
Oh, get rid of the two-party system. I'm on with you there.
Yeah, and but we could talk about that for hours. I can put on my tinfoil hat. I can put my hair back. I've got my long, crazy hair right now. I can grow my beard out for a couple more months. I can go live in a shack out in the woods so that I'm fully ready to have that talk. But that might be – you know, that might be a fun episode, but it also might be a batshit crazy episode. Am I allowed to swear?
Well, I mean, I suppose.
Okay, good, because I just swore.
I mean, some of our sponsors might not appreciate it.
Well, I don't think you have enough viewers to get demonetized yet. One day, though.
Can you demonetize zero? Can they charge me for putting it up?
You never know. You get fined.
I'm just here so I won't get fined. But, so it was called They Don't Represent Us. And, I mean, I think you made some great points about democracy reform, and I think that's going to be a very soon episode that we'll take on. So They Don't Represent Us by Lawrence Lessig. That's going to take us into our UBI because Andrew Yang, Democratic nominee, or Democratic candidate for president in the primaries, he ended up losing, got like sixth or seventh, I want to say. He was definitely my choice. He was a big proponent of a universal basic income. He wrote a book just maybe a few years ago titled The War on Normal People. Definitely a book that everyone should read. I keep on talking about how I don't have enough time to read books. One of his lines in there is that he was on a college campus and someone said that he can't wait to get done with college so that he can finally have some time to think. I don't know if that's a line that you've ever heard, but I think that's so true because I've got a long list of books that I'd like to read right now, but I just don't have the time for it.
Yeah, I feel similar that way. One thing I'll say, a little bit of a sidebar, but you brought it up. I also have a long list of books that I'd like to read. I got a long list of podcasts I'd like to listen to. On one particular podcast that I listen to, I won't name it, they had a guest speaker on, and he said, I listen to audiobooks, and I listen to podcasts. And every single one, I listen to 1.5 times speed. And ever since then, I've done that. Yeah, I might talk faster because of it. My mom can't listen to any podcasts or audiobooks in the car with me because she can't understand it. But I'm able to consume so much more information when I do that, that I've tore through countless books doing that. So, you know, get a subscription to an audiobook place.
I don't want to do that because the 1.5, and the other thing is I'm not very good at reading books while I drive a vehicle.
Yeah.
But I think I could
be hard.
I think I could be good at listening to books while I drive a vehicle.
Oh, yeah. I went on an extended drive this past weekend, and I knocked out 2 audiobooks just by driving in the car. You know, yeah, I love music, too, so every once in a while I'd switch back to music. But, you know, right now, a big thing for me, a big reason I'm going to law school is the pursuit of knowledge. I want to learn more things. I want to be more informed about things. And that's also why, you know, I enjoy talking to you because I feel like we both bring, you know, slightly different information to the table so we can learn from each other. Because I just want to learn stuff, you know, and that goes when I'm talking to anybody. I just want to learn and, you know, discover things.
Yeah, well, huge sidebar now.
Yeah.
But the title of the podcast, at least as of now, is Courtney Combos. And in the description of it, I talk about the conversation and how we need to either start the conversation or we need to change the conversation to the things that matter. But the most important thing is the conversation. And I feel like a thing right now that we're talking about in political science classes that I'm in is that these conversations aren't happening enough because over time, our society has moved back towards segregation as far as housing and where people live. So we have the white neighborhoods, we have the Christian neighborhoods, we have the Somali and Muslim neighborhoods, we have the Hispanic neighborhoods. It's not all of this intermixing. And then that goes for the schools. So then you have the schools where people who think like you are in your classes with you. So there's not the intermixing of different people being able to bring different things to the conversation and have the conversations. Too many times politically, I will want to have conversations with people who are maybe on the other side of the aisle and they aren't interested because one thing is that there isn't enough of the conversation. So sometimes people, I think, aren't good at having the tough conversations that I would say we need to have.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And we can you know, hope this might be a little teaser for an upcoming, for another episode, but I think we can definitely talk about a big issue right now is the massive political divide, because I'd say, and yeah, I wasn't 21 years old. I was a younger kid, but I don't remember anybody ever talking about politics with other people in public. And now that's all people want to talk about. They want to talk about politics at the dinner table, but they don't really want to talk about politics. They want to talk about their side and they don't want to hear anything else. And I think that's an issue. And I think that, you know, there definitely are people out there who want to hear both sides, who want to learn. And, you know, that might change their ideas, but we have such a strong divide. And I think that that goes all the way up to the top in the government. And when I say government, I don't mean Donald Trump. I don't mean Joe Biden. I mean everybody. I mean everybody that's in massive political power. Well, a lot of people in massive political power right now are so left or right wing that anybody who ascribes to what they believe in believes that they have to be far right or far left and that they can't be moderate. And that there can't be gray area to decisions.
And the other thing, touching on that, that I've noticed is, gosh, we're really talking too much about a teaser. But so I listen to Fox News every once in a while, and my parents will call me crazy. But I feel like there's not enough of that crossover and at least listening to what the other side has to say. First of all, I'm not a fan of CNN, MSNBC, or Fox News for the most part, the overwhelming majority of the time. I think every once in a while they have good points. But I think just listening to those takes and seeing what other people have to say can be beneficial.
Yeah, and if we can get there as a society, I think that that will do a lot of good.
All right, back on topic. Universal basic income. $12,000 a year, $1,000 a month. Andrew Yang really brought it to the forefront. I think it will happen within the next 10 years due to a lot of things related to automation and whatnot. What's your take on a universal basic income?
I really like the idea of it. I want to do more research into it because I know that, you know, maybe not to the extent of where we could potentially be going in the future, but it has been done in the past a couple of times, at least three or four times throughout the world. And I kind of want to see, you know, if it worked or, you know, what it affected. But I like the idea. Thinking about it kind of makes me excited. If someone told me you're going to get $12,000 extra a year, I'd say that's awesome. And yeah, you got to look into more the tax side of it and all that stuff. But honestly, that's a big economic debate that we could sit here and talk for hours on that. So I think that that's kind of, you know, beside the point. I think that it's a really cool idea and that it has a lot of merit.
Yeah. So Finland has recently done a study on it where they gave money to people and it was successful. And one of the big downsides that people bring up is that it might discourage work. But in that study and in every recent study that's been done, the only people who work less are young mothers caring for their newborns and older high school and college kids who graduate at higher rates. And I don't know about you, but I'm not going to go protest that, hey, these moms are caring for their kids and these kids are going to school. I don't think that's a good argument against a universal basic income.
No, I don't think so. And, you know, the other part of that, too, is there can be exceptions. It, like we were just talking about, it doesn't have to be black and white. There can be changes that can come. You know, they can change how it works. It doesn't have to work exactly the same way it did in Finland. It doesn't have to look exactly the same way it did in Finland. But I agree with that. I know today, if you told me that at the job I was going to be making, I was going to be making $12,000 a year more just because, I'd probably work a little bit harder. And I guarantee that there are a lot of other people in the United States, and even just people that I know personally, that if you told them, I'm going to give you a pay increase today for the rest of your life or even for 10, 20 years just because, and like that's a massive pay increase. It's not like you're getting a $1,000 raise. You're getting a $12,000 raise. That's a lot of money. That's enough money to pay for some college tuitions.
Yeah. Way back in just before 1970, in a nice year, Richard Nixon, a Republican president, brought forth a plan that was very similar to a universal basic income. He called it a guaranteed minimum income, which is very similar to it. The reason it didn't pass, actually passed the House of Representatives, the reason it didn't go through the Senate is because the Democrats wanted a plan that went further. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, Richard Nixon, Republican president who didn't do very much right and resigned because he would have been convicted and removed from office if he didn't.
Hey, he's not a crook.
But he had a good point there. And I think it's worth noting that it was a Republican was the first president in the United States to ever bring it up. And right now, I mean, neither Joe Biden or Donald Trump are in favor of it. I think you have a good argument that Donald Trump's closer to it. But I think it's something that needs to happen in the next decade.
Well, and you better dog ear that one for when we talk about how much bipartisanship sucks right there, because
I think we keep on bringing it back to the thing that we're talking about. I think the next podcast we're going to do this weekend is going to call Why Politics Suck. That's all we're going to call it.
Yeah.
And we're just going to talk about why politics, because it does.
Yeah.
There's so many problems with it. But then with the universal basic income, why is it not socialism, or is it socialism? Tell me about that.
Well, first of all, I don't think socialism is bad. I think if we dove all the way into socialism, so, you know, I was doing this beforehand, typed up on my little laptop to find a definition of socialism. Socialism, straight from Encyclopedia Britannica, is a social and economic doctrine that calls for public rather than private ownership or control of property and natural resources. And then, you know, skip to the last sentence of this paragraph of the explanation. Society as a whole, therefore, should own or at least control property for the benefit of all its members. I think if you take that as, you know, we don't have to lean all the way into that and be strictly that's exactly how we're going to run things. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that there is good in that. And when we talk about things, as humans, we crave community, we crave society. And that's a good thing. That helps us, you know, that makes us stronger as a human race. That makes us better people, you know, more caring, more sympathetic and empathetic towards people. So I think that that's good. And I think that it is okay that this and, you know, essentially some of the other things that we've talked about today are kind of socialism.
Yeah, well, I think you made some good points. And you almost said the C word, but you didn't say the C word.
I was going to say it.
Communism.
I was going to say it.
Communism is... So, in a lot of different definitions they could get, they would say that socialism is some type of a Goldilocks between communism and capitalism. And the big downside that people always talk about communism, that they're right, is that it corrupts, that it's too much control in the government's hands. But I don't think necessarily the problem is that there's too much control in the government's hands in communism. I think the problem is that there's too much control in one group of people's hands, because that's how corruption happens. It's just the same in a true laissez-faire, every man for themselves capitalism version, though. Like, I don't think anyone's arguing that Rockefeller didn't have enough power, that Vanderbilt didn't have enough power back in the Industrial Revolution. They had too much power. They weren't members of the government. But so that we need to find a way so that Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and the Walton family, we don't let them consolidate too much of the power. And I think that's the reason that we can't necessarily think of some type of a middle ground. Don't call me a socialist, because I'm not a socialist. But that's why that we need to change something so that we don't go overboard, because we're very close.
Right. And, you know, that was great. And, you know, to kind of piggyback off of that also, you know, and you might call me a communist for saying this. Communism is just a word and an idea. You know, we could call our government whatever type of government we wanted. I think that done correctly, really any type of government besides, I'll say, a dictatorship, if you did it correctly in a perfect world, you know, in economics, we talk about the perfect world. Everybody spends all their money perfectly. If you ran a government perfectly, besides a dictatorship, I think you could make any type of government work. Sadly, that's not the world we live in. So, yeah, communism kind of isn't very good. And in some regards, a hardcore socialism isn't always good.
Yeah, so we need to find some type of a middle ground, which is what I think universal basic income is. In the words of Andrew Yang, it isn't socialism, it's capitalism, where you don't start at zero. So that's his take on it, and I think he makes some good points. So how would we fund a universal basic income? So $12,000 a year, that is... You want to check my price tag on that. It's almost $3 trillion, I want to say, annually. So I'm going to keep talking. But so the way you would pay for it is a value-added tax. So what a value-added tax is it's basically a consumer-based tax similar to a sales tax, where it's – so in Europe, they have it for 20%, so 20 cents on the dollar. In America, we have it currently at 0 cents on the dollar. So Andrew Yang proposes going halfway there and going at 10 cents on the dollar. And that would be enough to fund a universal basic income. So if we think about that 10 cents, so economists would argue, and I'll let you get into this in just a second, economists would argue that those 10 cents wouldn't all fall on the consumer because, I mean, I'll let you get into that. But even if we say that those 10 cents all did fall on the consumer, then no one would lose money, true money, net money, if they made under or consumed under $120,000 a year. $120,000 times 0.1 equals $12,000. So that's pretty upper middle class, making $120,000 per person. So like if you and your wife both make $120,000, that would be $240,000, which is way up there. But so that's what that would mean. Is, and that's quite a bit of money. So if we think about that, that's really going to help the overwhelming majority of the population. And the 10 cents on the dollar, really the companies that's going to hurt are people like Amazon, who pay nearly nothing in federal income tax. The last year or two, they've paid very minimum, but they're able to avoid an income tax so easily that we need to find a better way to tax them, because it's a bad argument to say that philanthropy is the way that we're going to go through things. And I mean, you're going to touch on the overhead cost of it.
Yeah. So, you know, roughly about $4 trillion, you know, there's about just over 300. Oh, you just bumped my calculator out of here. So just under four.
No. Yeah,
am I counting my zeros right?
Well, so everyone wouldn't get a.
I'm saying total. 1 year, how much it would cost for everybody in the United States.
Yeah, but it's people 18 and over is what he talks about.
Oh, so, yeah, you're right, you hooligan. I looked at the raw census, so I did my math wrong. Good thing this was not on a homework assignment, because I would have got it wrong. But, you know, I was half listening to what he was saying as I was doing my intense computations of basic multiplication on a keyboard. But, yeah, if I was making $240,000... my wife and I, I don't have a wife, if I did have a wife, and we were making that amount of money, first off, we'd be pretty well off. And second off, what consumer confidence is, which is the goal of, you know, giving tax cuts to the upper percents. If I'm making that much money, I'm going to spend more money, and, you know, I'm going to spend it wisely, because I'm a person who has a little bit of financial literacy, but some of that's going to go towards fun things and towards things that I wouldn't be buying if I was making only $100,000 as a household income. So that's, you know, the same idea as consumer confidence with giving tax cuts to upper percents is the idea that if we give them a tax cut, that'll be more money in their pockets at the end of the day, at the end of the year, that they're going to go spend. But a lot of them, since they are philanthropists, that's a tough word to say, they know very much how to spend their money. They understand how the economy is working, and they a lot of times see before any of us do down here at the bottom when the economy is doing good or bad. So they're not going to go out and spend, at least proportionally, the amount of money that the government is hoping that they'll spend with consumer confidence. And so it's just sitting in a bank. It's sitting in real estate and in investments, and just piling up and making their pile bigger and bigger. And, you know, partially all the credit to them. I'm not a fan of, you know, eat the billionaires. You know, I think, like you were saying before, we don't want them to have, you know, as much wealth. We don't want them to have as much power and control as much power. But, you know, I give them credit. They're spending, they're using their money wisely, at least, you know, a lot of them. You know, some of them you could say, you know, maybe got their money through illegitimate means. But I think a lot of them got there pretty legitimately. And they're just, the government's giving them cuts and giving them breaks and letting them grow their money. And so if we, you know, incorporate factors like what we're talking UBI and all these other things, it puts money into normal people's hands, and that's where the consumer confidence really matters. Because yes, there are rich people and they have a ton of money, but if you have one really rich person spend a lot of money versus 100 average people spend a little bit of extra money, at the end of the day and at the end of the year and at the end of 10 years, at the end of a century, those 100 people are going to make a bigger impact.
Yeah. So Andrew Yang's freedom, he calls it the freedom dividend, would cost $2.8 trillion annually. So the way that he funds it, I'm going to go through the math real quick, but we'd get $1.6 trillion in new revenue through things like a value-added tax and a small carbon emissions tax. We generate just about $600 billion from new economic growth. So these people have more money in their hands, so they're spending more money. We'd have like $300 billion in savings from saving money on things like mental health and incarceration. Because if you think about it, these people aren't making that $12,000 a year if they're not in jail. So you're literally paying people not to go to jail. So you're going to save money on things like that. And already, boom, got you to $2.8 trillion. So the thing is, we can do it. I think we've proven it in this pandemic that when politicians say we don't have the money for it, that's kind of just BS, because we do have the money for it. It's the question of if they want to spend the money on that.
Right. And I'll go tin hatch here for 2 seconds. Money is fake and is all relative. We talk about fiat money, which is essentially what all our money is. Fiat money is just the government says, hey, here's some money. It's money because I told you it is. All right. Tinfoil hat off.
Well, we're gonna touch on that a little bit more, because I think people don't quite understand why it is that. So a deficit isn't necessarily a great thing to just forever go into a huge hole, but it's also not the biggest thing, because if you think about a deficit, why would it matter? The only reason it would matter is if you default on your loans. First of all, a lot of our deficit is to ourselves. The majority of it is. Some of it is to China. Some of it is to Japan, maybe a few countries in the European Union. But the majority of it is to ourselves. And the only reason that it would matter is if we default on our loans and we get a bad credit rating. But how would you default on your loans? Well, the same way that an American citizen would default on your loans. If you don't have enough money to pay your loan, you default on your loan. But the reason that that doesn't really apply to the United States government is because we print our own money. So if we don't have enough money, we just print more money. So in the world of investing, and invest in the United States federal government in bonds is the best investment that you can make as far as risk, because they can't default on their loans. It's nearly impossible.
Yeah. And, you know, that's actually kind of, you know, becoming a topic in terms of, you know, more under the carpet. You know, a lot of people don't, you know, care as much about government bonds, but that's going away a little bit, actually. And, you know, I don't fully understand why that is. I just know that, you know, in terms of risk, it is the lowest. But, you know, I was told by a couple people, don't buy government bonds anymore, you know.
Well, so a big thing I think in that is that people think you can make more money putting your money elsewhere.
Right. Which is true if you know how to do it.
Yeah. But as far as risk, because the United States is going to be able to pay your money back. That's what I meant by that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know.
So, and then we're going to go back to the universal basic income. So the reason that this is needed, why do we need this? Can't people just go back to work? So the reality is we're going through, as Andrew Yang called it, a fourth industrial revolution, where there are not going to be the same number of jobs, especially after this pandemic. If we think about a company like Tesla. What do? They create self-driving cars. What is one of the highest consumed occupations, jobs that most people have in the United States? A truck driver. That's not going to exist 20 years from now. Those people aren't going to have jobs. What about these retailers? They're not going to exist because of Amazon. And Amazon isn't going to have as much work because they're working on robots, so they don't need people in their facilities. But we can't just say screw you to all these people. And we can't just say that, well, you'll figure it out. Because this is more so a thing than at any other time in our society. So if we don't give these people money, They won't have ways to spend money. And the thing is, if that we give them money to spend, then it just keeps on flowing. And if every person in your city has $12,000 more a year, they're going to have a few more bucks to go out to eat every once in a while. And if you go out to eat, if everyone goes out to eat a little more, guess what? The restaurant is going to hire a few more people. And that is the philosophy behind why we need a universal basic income. So in the other way that you save money, the reason it's a very capitalist proposal, is you start to cut some things like unemployment insurance, food stamps, housing vouchers. It's a use it or lose it type of situation, so you pick. But the majority of people are going to pick a universal basic income because they're able to go back to work. That's why it's a pro-work thing and why it isn't socialism. Because, I mean, right now a critique on the unemployment insurance is that people aren't going back to work. Well, if you make it unconditional, those people are able to go back to work.
Right.
And I don't think it's a good argument that if you give people $12,000 a year, they're going to sit at home. I don't think $12,000 a year is below the poverty line, which is why they set it there. So these people are still going to go back and try to find work, even with $12,000 a year.
Right. And, you know, with in terms of unemployment benefits, we saw that in 2008, and we're going to see that now. And the really hard thing is the bad people are ruining it for the good people, because there are plenty of people who are working their asses off trying to get back to work and really need that unemployment. And then there's that Joe Schmo who got laid off and says, the government's going to pay me to sit on my ass at home. I'm going to do that for the full 12 months. And a lot of people argue we need to be harsher on unemployment benefits. And I think that if you incorporated this UBI, it's a great incentive because it's giving you money. It's giving you money to, you know, to have time because, you know, hopefully if we establish the system, then you're going to be smarter with your money and you're going to spend and save money and invest money better so that when, you know, economic turmoil comes about, you have a little bit of cushion. But then down the road, while yes, the money is coming from the government, you're not as reliant on the government to give you an unemployment check the day that you get fired. You still have some supplemental income to give you a little bit of time to figure out what you're going to do in hopefully 2-3 months from now. And, you know, talking about robots and, you know, the takeover, the cyborg takeover, I kind of disagree. I think that, yes, initially we're going to lose some jobs, but I think that in the long run, it's going to create more jobs too, because we're going to see where robots don't work. I personally think that you can never have a robot as a doctor. You could have a robot as a surgeon potentially, but I don't think as a doctor or as a nurse, because, you know, at least where we are now, and if you get into the point where robots can learn emotions and can become humans, that's too scary to think about. So let's not think about that. Robots don't really have emotions, which means they don't have bedside manner. And there are plenty of services and jobs where you need that. You need that human touch. And so I think it's just going to create more jobs that are different jobs.
Yeah, I mean, you're right in a way, but the way you're wrong, I mean, that's a little bit smart, but is the three biggest jobs in the United States are truck drivers, retail workers, and fast food workers. And those jobs are going to go away. And the reason that this is different is because it is caused by other things, so it's going to happen faster. And at least over the next, say, 50 years, where our economy is going to transition, we need something to carry us over, if you will, while that is happening. Because otherwise, we're going to have so many people that are just left behind. Because it doesn't work that, say, you're a truck driver, and then next year you're just able to become a lawyer.
Right.
Or next year you're able to become a truck driver. Or it's not like those people are going to want to do that either. And that's the reason that it doesn't necessarily just work to just say that people are going to find other work.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I think we're wrapping it up. So what's your favorite of these three?
I think, you know, it's kind of pretty. It's kind of the glam, the glitz one. I kind of like UBI. I definitely want to look more into, and, you know, if you listen to this and you have a way to contact me, let me know your input. Let me know if you have some information that we missed out on any of these, because I'd love to hear more and learn more. But I think that UBI could be really great.
Yeah, no, I do too. And I think it's going to be the policy that is going to make someone a president like FDR, where they're everyone's favorite, and geez, they wish they could be president for more than two terms, even though they can't. So that's what I think. I also think we need a universal basic income. Do I think it will happen? Yes, maybe not. It won't happen over Trump's term. Maybe it'll happen in the next Democratic administration, whether that be Biden-Harris or someone else in 2024. I guess we'll just have to wait and see on that. So thank you for joining me, Tanner. We'll probably do this more, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, so maybe once, maybe twice a week. Thank you for joining us. Episode 2, Corny Combos with Tanner Binzek. Play the music.